Imagine for a second that you have a map of the world.
Okay.
But it's not a normal map.
Yeah.
On this map, the majestic, sprawling Himalayas are represented by this microscopic dot.
Right.
And the tiny, narrow alleyway behind your house, that takes up half the page.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a world where size is completely backwards, a parallel dimension where massive objects shrink to nothing, and the tiniest details explode outward to infinity. It sounds like something out of a theoretical physics paper on the multiverse or, you know, Alice in Wonderland.
It does sound like fantasy, doesn't it? But for anyone working in materials science or crystallography or even solid-state physics, this isn't a fantasy at all. It's a daily reality. It is the mathematical air they breathe.
Yeah, exactly. And today, we're going to explore that inverted reality. We're doing a deep dive into Chapter 5 of HKDH Padaccia's Geometry of Crystals, Polycrystals, and Phase Transformations.
Fantastic text.
It is. And our topic today is the reciprocal lattice. And I have to be honest with you and with everyone listening, when I first cracked this chapter open, I hit a wall.
Oh, I think everyone does.
I mean, I looked at the diagrams and I just thought, why? Why do we need a fake inverted lattice to understand a real solid chunk of metal?
Yeah.
It just felt like making things complicated just for the sport of it.
Yeah, I think almost everyone has that exact reaction the first time they encounter the reciprocal lattice. It feels like this unnecessary abstraction.
Totally.
Because, you know, we have the real lattice, the atoms you can touch, the physical structure that holds up a bridge. So why invent a second imaginary one where everything is just upside down?
It feels like a math trick.
But here is the secret, and this is really the key to our whole deep dive today.
Yeah.
It is not a trick. The reciprocal lattice is actually what you physically see when you try to look at atoms.
Wait, really?
Yeah. When you shine X-rays or electrons at a crystal, you don't get a photograph of the atoms. You get a diffraction pattern. You get these spots of light on a detector.
Oh, right. Those patterns that look kind of like star charts.
Exactly. And that pattern is the reciprocal lattice. So we aren't studying some fake mathematical construct here. We are learning the language of diffraction. If you want to see the atomic world, you literally have to learn to read in reverse.
So in a way, the source material isn't just teaching us abstract math. It's handing us a Rosetta Stone.
That is the perfect way to frame it.
It's teaching us how to translate those weird dots of light back into physical reality.
Spot on.
Okay, let's unpack this. If we're going to survive in this inverted world, we need to know the rules.
We do.
We need to define the basis. So in the real world, inside a crystal, we have our unit cell, that little box that repeats over and over. And that box is defined by three vectors, right? A one, a two, and a three.
Right. Those vectors define the edges of your physical building block. They tell you how big the atoms are and how far apart they sit in real space.
But then Padaccia introduces their reciprocal basis sectors, a star one, a star two, and a star three. And the relationship between the real ones and these new star vectors seems, I don't know, oddly specific. It's not just a random flip.
No, it's strictly geometric, and this definition is absolutely crucial. The text explains that the reciprocal vector, A star 1, is constructed based on the other two real vectors, A2 and A3.
Okay.
Specifically, A star 1 creates a direction that is perpendicular to the plane formed by A2 and A3.
Let's visualize that for the listener. So imagine I'm standing in a room, my unit cell.
Okay, you're in the box.
The floor is defined by two arrows, A2 and A3.
Mm-hmm.
Does the reciprocal vector, a star one, just shoot straight up out of the floor?
Exactly. It points normal or perpendicular to that face of the crystal. So the reciprocal lattice is fundamentally a map of directions perpendicular to the atomic planes.
Got it.
But getting the direction is the easy part. The part that trips people up and the reason it's called reciprocal is the magnitude, the actual length of that arrow.
This is the inversion rule we teased in the intro.
Right. The length of that reciprocal vector is inversely proportional to the spacing between the atomic planes. The text writes this as the magnitude of A star equals 1 over D, where D is the distance between those layers of atoms.
Let's make sure I've got this straight. If I have a crystal where the layers of atoms are really far apart, so large D spacing, the reciprocal vector is
tiny, very short.
And if I take a hydraulic press and smash those atomic planes super close together, making D really small,
then the reciprocal vector shoots out and becomes huge.
It really is an upside down world.
Yeah.
Large becomes small, small becomes large. But why? Why does the physics actually work that way?
Think about ripples in a pond or a diffraction grating in optics. If you have a grating with lines that are very close together, it scatters light at very wide angles.
Right.
But if the lines are far apart, the light hardly bends at all. Diffraction naturally behaves inversely to the size of the object. The reciprocal lattice is just the mathematical way of capturing that physical reality.
So when a scientist looks at a detector and sees two spots that are really far apart, they don't have to do complex mental gymnastics.
Not at all.
They just know. Big separation on the screen means tiny separation in the atoms.
Instantaneously. You stop seeing the dots as abstract math and start seeing them as a direct map of atomic density.
That actually makes the Miller indices make way more sense.
Oh, absolutely.
Because we've talked about Miller indices in previous deep dives. Those HKL numbers used to label crystal planes. In real space, they always felt a bit clunky to me.
Right.
You have to visualize where a plane cuts the axis and take fractions.
They can be a massive headache in real space. But in the reciprocal world, the Miller indices HKL are just coordinates.
Just coordinates of a point?
Exactly. The point located at HKL in the reciprocal lattice represents the vector that is perfectly perpendicular to the physical plane, HKL. It unifies the plane and its direction into a single, simple arrow.
That's much cleaner. It turns a 3D geometric shape, a plane, into a simple data point.
And because it's so clean, it allows for some very fast, very practical math. The source material brings up something called the Weissohn Law. Equation 5.3.
It sounds like a thriller movie title. Enter the Weissohn.
It does sound dramatic.
Yeah.
But it's actually just a sanity check tool for engineers. Suppose you're designing a new alloy, and you need to know if a specific direction in the crystal, let's call it direction U, V, W, lies flat inside a specific plane, HKL.
In the real world, I'd probably need to build a 3D model or draw a really complicated diagram to figure that out.
But with the reciprocal lattice, you just use arithmetic. Because the reciprocal vector is perpendicular to the plane, if your direction lies in the plane, it must be perpendicular to that reciprocal vector.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Right, and mathematically, the dot product of perpendicular vectors is zero.
So I just multiply the numbers. H times U plus K times V.
Plus L times W. If the sum is zero, you're good. The direction is in the plane. If it's not zero, it's not.
That is incredibly convenient. It's like a cheat code.
It really is. It saves an immense amount of time when you're orienting crystals for experiments.
Okay, so we've built the world. We have our inverted vectors. We have our cheat codes. Now let's talk about the main event. The reason we built this world in the first place. Diffraction. The text spends a lot of time connecting this to Bragg's Law.
Yes. Everyone learns Bragg's Law in physics class. N lambda equals 2d sine theta.
Right.
It connects the wavelength, the atomic spacing, and the angle. It's a great equation, but it's a scalar equation. It just deals with simple numbers. It gets really messy when you're dealing with a complex 3D crystal rotating in space.
And the source material claims Bragg's Law gets a kind of glow-up in reciprocal space.
It becomes incredibly elegant. It transforms into a simple vector equation. K prime minus K equals G.
Short and sweet. But let's decode it for the listeners. What are K and K prime?
K is the wave vector of your incoming beam. Imagine the laser pointer of X-rays hitting the sample. K prime is the wave vector of the beam bouncing off, and G is a vector in the reciprocal lattice.
So it's saying the difference between what goes in and what comes out must exactly match a step in the reciprocal lattice.
Precisely. It's fundamentally a statement about the conservation of momentum, and this simple equation leads to the most important visual tool in the entire chapter. Figure 5.4. The Ewald sphere.
I loved this visual. It finally made the concept click for me. Can you walk the listener through what the Ewald sphere construction actually looks like?
I'd love to. Imagine you are floating in this reciprocal space. You see a cloud of points, the reciprocal lattice, hanging in the dark like stars.
Okay, I'm picturing the star field.
Each point represents a set of planes in the physical crystal. Now, you draw a sphere in this space. The size of the sphere is fixed by the energy of your X-ray beam. The center of the sphere is where your crystal sits.
Oh, right.
Now, here is the golden rule of diffraction. You only get a signal, you only see a spot on your detector if one of those star points touches the surface of that sphere.
So it's a game of geometry. If the point is inside the sphere, nothing happens. If it's outside, nothing happens. It has to perfectly kiss the shell.
Exactly. It's like a game of cosmic billiards.
And this explains why crystallographers are always rotating their samples, right?
Yes, exactly. When you rotate the physical crystal in your hand or in the machine, you are spinning that entire star field of reciprocal points. You're rotating the cloud. And as you spin it, different points sweep through the surface of that stationary sphere.
And every time a point crosses the shell bingo, you get a diffraction spot.
Exactly. It turns the complex physics of wave interference into a simple intersection problem. Does the point touch the sphere? Yes or no?
But there's a catch. There is always a catch in these deep dives.
There is. Just because a point touches the sphere doesn't guarantee you'll actually see a spot.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Sometimes the geometry is perfect, the Bragg condition is met, the point touches the sphere, but the detector sees nothing. The spot is just missing.
The text calls this systematic absences. It sounds like a glitch in the matrix.
It's nature's way of playing hide and seek. The text explains this using the structure factor, or F(HKL).
We have to remember that these points aren't just abstract math dots. They represent real atoms.
Correct. The reciprocal lattice points tell you where diffraction could happen based on the shape of the box. But the atoms inside the box determine how loud the signal actually is.
Because the X-rays are scattering off multiple atoms at once, and those waves interact.
And that interaction can be destructive. Padecia uses the body-centered cubic, or BCC, lattice as example 5.2.
Let's walk through that.
Imagine a cube with atoms at the eight corners and one single atom sitting in the dead center of the box.
Okay, I got the cube, corner atoms, center atom.
Now, think about the X-rays reflecting off the top and bottom faces of the cube. The 0, 0, 1 planes, the waves bouncing off the corners are all in sync. But the wave bouncing off that center atom, well, where is it?
It's exactly halfway between the top and bottom.
Right, so the path length is different.
It's different by exactly half a wavelength. So when the wave from the corner zigs, the wave from the center zags.
Perfectly out of phase. So they cancel out.
Wow.
It's total silence. The intensity is exactly zero. So even though the geometry says there should be a spot here, the physics of the interference says nope.
But if we look at a different set of planes, say the 0, 0, 2 planes.
For 0, 0, 2, the angle is sharper, the geometry changes. Now the center atom is exactly one full wavelength behind, and being one full step behind means you're back in sync.
Everyone is singing in chorus again.
And you get a strong bright spot.
This is fascinating because it means the silent, the missing spot, is actually a clue.
Mm.
If I look at a pattern and see that every other spot is deleted, I could deduce, aha, there must be an atom hiding in the center of the unit cell causing that cancellation.
You are basically Sherlock Holmes at that point. Mm. You are looking for the dog that didn't bark. The absences tell you the internal symmetry of the unit cell.
Let's apply this detective work to a real-world mystery from the source material. Example 5.4. This involves an alloy of iron, aluminum, and carbon.
Yes. This is a classic case study in order versus disorder. It's really where this stuff becomes incredibly useful for making actual things.
We have two phases mentioned in the text, gamma and kappa. Gamma is a solid solution and kappa is a precipitate. For the non-metallurgists listening, what's the difference?
Think of gamma as a disordered solid solution. Imagine a movie theater where you have iron people and aluminum people. In the disordered phase, they just sit randomly, iron next to aluminum, aluminum next to aluminum. It's a total mix.
Okay.
The X-ray just sees an average blob at every seat.
On the kappa phase.
The kappa phase is ordered. It has a strict recipe, AL3 Fay. In this movie theater, the ushers are very strict. The iron atoms must sit in the corner seats. The aluminum atoms must sit in the face seats. No mixing allowed.
So how does our inverted map, the reciprocal lattice, show us the difference between a random crowd and assigned seating?
It comes back to those missing spots we just talked about. In the disordered gamma phase, since every seat looks statistically identical, the crystal looks like a simple face-centered cube. It has high symmetry, which means lots of spots are canceled out. They are forbidden.
But when the atoms suddenly snap into their assigned seats in the kappa phase?
You break that symmetry. Suddenly, the corners look different from the faces. The destructive interference that was hiding those spots stops working perfectly.
So new spots appear on the detector.
Yes. We call them superlattice reflections. For example, the 1, 0, 0 spot.
Mm-hmm.
In the disordered phase, it's completely invisible. In the ordered phase, it lights up.
That is the smoking gun.
Mm.
If you see that 1, 0, 0 spot appear, you know, ordering has happened. The alloy is transformed.
Exactly. But the text notes a practical difficulty here. It's a real challenge for the detective. Iron and aluminum are neighbors on the periodic table. Iron has 26 electrons. Aluminum has 13.
So they aren't that different in size or scattering power.
Not compared to, say, uranium versus hydrogen. Because their scattering factors are somewhat similar, the contrast between iron at the corner and aluminum at the face is very low.
Meaning those extra superlattice spots are?
Very, very faint. It's like trying to spot the difference between a crowd wearing dark navy shirts and a crowd wearing black shirts. You really have to squint.
But if you can see them, they tell you something crucial about the strength of the material. Padecia mentions dislocations in this section.
This is the so what factor. Why do we even care if it's ordered? It's because of how defects move. In the disordered phase, a dislocation, which is just a ripple in the atomic carpet, can slide through relatively easily.
But in the ordered kappa phase,
if a single dislocation moves through the ordered phase, it shifts the atoms by one step. It would physically push an iron atom into an aluminum seat.
Oh, that ruins the seating chart.
And nature hates that. It creates a fault, a plane of high energy wrong bonds. So what happens is that a second dislocation follows immediately behind the first one.
Like the buddy system.
Exactly. The first one messes up the order and the second one shifts it again, restoring the perfect arrangement. So in these materials, defects travel in pairs. We call them super dislocations.
And moving two connected defects is harder than moving one.
Much harder. That makes the material stronger and much harder to deform. And we can infer all of this mechanics just from seeing those faint little dots on the reciprocal lattice.
That is incredible. A faint dot on a screen tells you that the material is strong enough to build a jet engine.
It's the power of the tool.
Now, we've been talking about ideal conditions, but the source material throws us a curveball in section 5.4. What happens when the crystal is incredibly thin?
This is really important for microscopists using transmission electron microscopy, or TEM. In TEM, your metal sample is thinned down until it's transparent to electrons, usually less than 100 nanometers thick.
Does the reciprocal lattice actually change when the sample gets that thin?
It does. We've been treating reciprocal lattice points as ideal sharp dots. That's true for a big, thick crystal. But the math of diffraction says that if you shrink the object in real space, you expand it in reciprocal space.
The inversion rule strikes again.
It does. If the crystal is incredibly thin in one direction, let's say the vertical Z direction, the reciprocal lattice points elongate in that same direction. They stop being dots and stretch out into rods or spikes.
Okay, so how does having rods instead of dots change our game of cosmic billiards with the Ewald sphere?
It makes the game much easier to win. Remember, usually you have to be at the exact perfect angle for the sphere to touch a tiny dot. It's a high-precision sport.
But if the dot stretches into a long rod,
the sphere can intersect that rod over a much wider range of angles.
This is the bigger target.
Exactly. It relaxes the Bragg condition. You can be slightly off axis, your tilt can be imperfect, and you will still get a strong diffraction signal because that rod is piercing the Ewald sphere.
So thin crystals are a bit more forgiving for the operator.
Much more forgiving. But it also means you have to be very careful interpreting the data because you might see spots that technically shouldn't be there based on the perfect geometry.
We're coming to the end of the chapter, and Badesia switches gears. We've talked about X-rays and electrons, but the text finishes with neutron diffraction. Why do we need a third way to look at crystals?
Neutrons have a superpower that X-rays simply don't. X-rays scatter off electrons, so if you have a big, thick chunk of steel, X-rays can't get very far. They interact too strongly with the surface electrons.
They just bounce off the skin.
Exactly. But neutrons, they have no charge. They are neutral. They sail right through the electron cloud and scatter directly off the tiny atomic nucleus.
So they can punch right through the material.
They can penetrate several centimeters of steel. This lets us see deep inside massive components, like engine blocks or pipeline welds.
Figure 5.14 in the text shows a cross-section of a steel weld. Looks kind of like a weather map with contour lines.
That is a map of residual stress. When you weld metal, the intense heating and cooling locks in massive internal forces. The metal wants to shrink, but it's stuck.
So the lattice is being squeezed.
Squeezed in some places, stretched in others. And since the lattice spacing D changes under stress,
the reciprocal lattice vector changes.
You got it. By mapping these tiny, tiny shifts in the position of the diffraction spots deep inside the weld, we can calculate the strain. The figure shows contours of stress, hundreds of megapascals hidden inside the metal.
That is information you simply cannot get any other way. If you cut the sample open to look, you'd release the stress you're trying to measure.
Exactly. It's a completely non-destructive way to see the invisible forces holding the structure together or threatening to tear it apart.
It's a really compelling argument.
Yeah.
You know, we started this deep dive thinking the reciprocal lattice was an unnecessary complication, a fake inverted world. But it turns out it's the only lens we have to see the real world clearly.
It really is. Whether you are finding an atom hiding in a unit cell, checking if an alloy is ordered and strong, or ensuring a pipeline weld is safe, you are using the reciprocal lattice.
I want to leave the listener with a thought, something you hinted at earlier. We usually think of the hard chunk of metal as the reality, and the math is just a description.
Right.
But in quantum mechanics, particles are waves. The diffraction pattern, that reciprocal space, is the direct representation of those waves.
It raises a provocative question. We can never really touch the atoms. We only interact with their fields and forces. The reciprocal lattice describes the frequencies and periodicities of those fields perfectly.
So is the mathematical description, the reciprocal lattice, actually more real, more fundamental to the physics of the universe than the physical chunk of metal we hold in our hand? Are we the ones living in the inverted dimension?
That is definitely a question to keep you up at night.
On that mind-bending note, thanks for diving deep with us into the geometry of crystals.
Always a pleasure.
See you next time.